Hello and welcome to the Multiplanetary Society podcast, where we explore topics related to the space economy and the why and how of potentially becoming a multiplanetary species. I'm your host, Timothy Reuter. Today, we are pleased to have with us Casey Dreyer, Chief Advocate and Senior Space Policy Advisor for the Planetary Society. Casey, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
To start off, can you please tell our listeners what the Planetary Society, just one planet so far, what the Planetary Society does and what it means to be the Chief Advocate and Policy Advisor?
Yeah, the Planetary Society is a nonprofit, member-supported organization that was founded in 1980 by Carl Sagan and Lou Friedman and Bruce Murray, who was the director of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at the time. And it's predicated on this idea that people love space exploration and space scientific exploration and want to support it and engage with it and just get excited by it, right? This was a very new concept at the time. And it has proven a correct hypothesis, right? We've been a member-supported organization now for over 40 years. Bill Nye, the science guy, is our current CEO of the organization. And we have about 50,000 members across the world who pay member dues. And we reach about 2 million other additional supporters and followers via newsletters, online social media channels. And what we really try to focus on is kind of three core areas to us: planetary exploration, that includes by humans and robots, planetary defense, right? We don't want to get smacked by an asteroid, and the search for life, which is, I think, one of the most soul-stirring, potential, revolutionarily just transcendental experiences that we could experience as individuals and as a species. And that's what really drives us. And so in that context, we try to educate people, we try to get people involved. And in my particular area, I work in the policy side. So I try to represent our interests to the U.S. government and other governments. I try to empower and educate our members to be better citizens so they can advocate for space as well. And then we also try to come up with policy solutions and ideas for how can we better explore the cosmos around us smartly and with good use of taxpayer money, and to really drive our discoveries forward and push back these boundaries of ignorance that we have about the world around us and the cosmos around us. So that's the short version, and I'm happy to expand on any one of those.
Yeah. And part of the reason I wanted to talk with you is because I think even more difficult than building the technology to become a multiplanetary species, which is obviously the framing of this podcast, is going to be the challenge of building a social movement that supports the kind of expenditures needed to do it. And so, you know, a lot of what I want to talk with you about today is how do you build a social movement around science topics and space in particular? And you sort of started addressing that with the structure of the Planetary Society, but I'd love to hear you dive deeper into how you think about that challenge of mobilizing large groups of people to support this agenda that you laid out.
Yeah, I mean, that's the basic challenge to every political organization, or we can even step back, right? I mean, and so we can frame some things a little bit here, which I think are important, which you make this nice distinction, right? We have these technological challenges that are not to be dismissed. We have serious, difficult, but technology in a way is the easy part, because you hammer away at it enough, and as long as it doesn't break the laws of physics, there's probably some pathway to solving it, which is what the Apollo program really was as a case study, right? Where at that brief period, the political side said, here's all the money you need. And then it was just a pure technological problem after that. And we did it, you know, took less than 10 years. But the political and sociological aspects of it are real and much more difficult to solve for, because it's a non-bounded problem, right? The problem space you're working in is also people are non-rational actors, and mm-hmm. you know, which fine, like none of us is purely rational, none of us are Vulcans, and then we're also competing with a set of dynamic and shifting other priorities for mm-hmm. attention. And how do we address these in a larger sense? There's no one answer to it, but I think what we have, and this is why I think organizations like the Planetary Society are important, is that we have a constant pressure in one direction over time. And I think that's like one of the key things, is having clarity of focus, clarity of effort, and that the clarity of a single outcome or set mm-hmm. of outcomes that help drive us forward to a certain goal over time, as opposed to kind of chasing after whatever hot thing of the moment is, or just, you know, or problem at the moment to solve. And so we start with that, I think, is to answer your question most directly. We want to know what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And a good example of this, you can to kind of shift the model a bit, is kind of how SpaceX approaches this too, where everything that SpaceX does is in the service of this long-term Martian settlement goal, mm-hmm. right? And that helps with that one goal. You can kind of work backwards and derive, where do we invest in technology now? What types of skills do we need to develop now? What types of capabilities are we going to need that we can start to leverage early, you know, for these medium-term goals, but mm-hmm. then will ultimately feed into what we're trying to do. And absent a goal, you can't make those decisions. You can't make the investments or prioritizations now if you don't know where you're going to go. So it's the similar sense for, I think, for talking with people in the public and galvanizing people in the public, but also giving them an understanding about where we're going. And then I think the other key part of that is convincing people, and some people need more convincing than others, which is good, is totally mm-hmm. fair, that they do have a role in this, that there's mm-hmm. everyone has a piece of the responsibility, while at the same time doesn't have a clear delineation within it, if that makes sense, right? Like it's like any kind of vote you take in a broad democratic system, one person's vote is not generally going to be the difference between winning mm-hmm. and losing. But if everyone thought that way, we wouldn't have a democratic system, right? We wouldn't have a winner at all, right? So everyone's vote matters, but also everyone's individual vote is marginal on paper. So it's a sense of like belonging into this larger movement where you mm-hmm. have, in a sense, a certain amount of faith that what you're doing contributes to something, even if there's no clear and immediate connection to what that is, which sounds maybe a bit abstract and esoteric, but I think is really important aspect of working in a broad social structure. So I'll turn it over to you. That was a long answer, but that you'll find. Well, that
it was
that.
A complicated question, and yeah, I wanted to hear your
it's
thoughts
a big
on
question.
It.
Yeah, absolutely a big question.
And sort of relatedly, what can we learn about other movements rooted in science, like attempts to fight climate change, and mm-hmm. you know, apply that to the space side? What do you think we can learn, or where do you think the analogs don't hold up?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to learn from that. And there's a couple lessons I think we can take. Climate change is a good example, because that is a good area where the ideas have been percolating for decades, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, we started thinking about global warming and catastrophic runaway global warming by studying planets like Venus, right? Which is one of those nice things of why we study the cosmos, for these weird edge cases that then is like, oh man, I hope we don't become that. But you start with the science, right? You start with the data, and you start with, in a sense, you have to create an understanding and a framework of what's happening. And then understanding, okay, so in a climate change, like, oh, this is happening to Earth. We need to do something to stop it. Here's how we can stop it. And you start creating policy solutions. And I think this is the key step for me. It's not enough to have a topic and then you just immediately get people to advocate for it. Mm-hmm. You need to have this middle point where you say, what do we want to achieve through the policy structures of the systems that we have, right? So in a democratic mm-hmm. society, we write laws. Those laws are functional, you know, those are what policy is. Or, and there's also this kind of other thing, you have this regulatory administrative state where it's like, what they can take those laws and then they have to interpret them and apply them. And so there's kind of, how do you help them interpret it in a way that's really productive as well, right? So you can kind of advocate to both the administrative mm-hmm. part of the state and the legislative part of the state. And that's what policy is. It's like, this is what we should do and how we should do it. And so over time with global warming and climate change, there's been a lot of work put into the policy of how you address it, right? Mm-hmm. And so you have these experts and think tanks and other people who sit down, study the problem, and then say, okay, how does this translate? You're almost like translating translating from one domain to another, right? So it's mm-hmm. like, okay, here's the physical world where climate change is happening, and then we're translating that into the policy, abstract policy language world in which government works. And you need people to kind of do that translation so you kind of have this kind of effect coming out of it. And then once you have that, you can build, again, these like broad movements over time. And I think it's one of those things where you can – it doesn't look like a lot is happening necessarily. But then because you've laid the groundwork from your agreed upon policy solutions, education and outreach to people, that you hit like a flipping point. And then suddenly it's one of the biggest issues, at least in one fraction of the, mm-hmm. of the political party, but also broadly around the world. It's not a partisan issue for the most part. And it's like, OK, we've established this foundation that has then been pushed forward for years. And now is this widely understood issue, and here's kind of ways to solve it. And then it becomes a political question of like, okay, here's the paths to solve it. And then the political process says, okay, what's feasible through the, you know, through these policies that we can implement to actually make a change on it. So space is kind of like that, right? Where you, but much, much less investment going into it.
Right.
And that tends to track with things that are more abstract, which it is to some degree. I would argue for planetary defense, it's as big of an issue that it's just kind of, we just brush off and pretend it doesn't exist. But you need more investment, I think, in the idea generation and the policy generation of translating, you know, the goals into law, and then also creating the foundational intellectual baseline that then outreach and educates all these people who have the means to change it, public, but also particularly people who go into political institutions.
And how do you think about the role of aspiration versus fear in mobilizing people? And I think this has been something that's been very interesting to observe in the climate change movement. I mean, for a while, it sort of seemed to be the narrative was, you know, focus on love of the planet and sort of preserving the cute penguins. And as time has progressed and that hasn't been as effective as people wanted, it's moved more towards, you know, either we're all going to die, or at least our grandkids are going to die, or, you know, or billions of people are going to find where they live uninhabitable. Mm-hmm. So take this seriously because a very bad thing is coming. And I've observed some of this sort of tension in the space community going from, you know, very aspirational, you know, we'll get cool science out of it, humans are meant to be explorers, versus, you know, some of the scarier things. I mean, yeah, a large enough asteroid hits, we really are all going to die. And, you know, there's other kinds of existential risks that people talk about. So in your communications, how do you balance that, and along mm-hmm. with, you know, maybe you have a different sense of what the truth is in terms of the dangers, but you know, would love to hear your thoughts on fear versus love.
Yeah, that's the light and dark side of the force base. That's, well, actually it's a very good nerd out a bit here. It is like the dark side of the force, where fear is the more seductive, easier and immediately powerful motivator, right? Where yes. But at the end of the day, it can be a bit nihilistic and shallow in that motivation, right? So I think that the positive structuring things as a positive outcome framework has advantages, but it doesn't, you know, it takes longer, right? It's harder to do. It's like a it's like the specific impulse of a rocket or whatever, you know, like it's going to be a softer push, but over a long period. So it's like it's like an electric propulsion device, right? Very efficient over time, but takes not a high amount of thrust, where fear is like a high thrust, then burn out quickly kind of a thing. And people after a while, they just shut off fear, right? And that's what I worry about with some of these more dire predictions for things like climate and other things, is like, well, we're doomed anyway. And so that's where, I mean, you get to this nihilism where it's just like, well, maybe just nothing matters, because it's too big of a problem. People need to feel like problems are solvable. And what I like about and what I think space offers actually is this like blessed relief from the direness of so many other things.
Yeah. Yes.
And we've found that particularly when communicating with like elected officials and their staff and others, where every day in a congressional member's office, like their staff is getting people yelling at them about mm-hmm. something or negative about something, pissed off about something. And when we come in, we can say, hey, take a break and say, what's something uplifting? What's something beautiful? What's something exciting? What's something that stirs the soul? This is what this is. This is our, I always call, you know, space is a better angel of our nature made manifest, right? Space exploration. And it's this moment of grace for some people where they say, wow, this was the best half hour of my day talking about something positive. And so I think there's actually, my preference is the positivity. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there are appropriate periods where we have to frame things negatively. When something, and that's what also makes it more effective, right? So if we're generally positive and talking about what can be done, and I think that's, again, that's just a better attitude to always frame one's personal engagement with the world is like try, mm-hmm. I think our brains just default into a negative state, and it's nice to try to frame as a positive state. But when something bad is legitimately happened and we have to say it's bad, then it means something too. And I think that's the problem. If everything is framed as bad or disastrous or we're all going to die, then nothing stands out. We're just in this miasma of negativity, where if we're generally positive and say, okay, well, now this one thing is actually kind of bad, people, okay, well, that's different. Like, this is a serious situation. And then what we try to do is, once that moment has passed, so if there's like a series of budget cuts or bad policies mm-hmm. being proposed, you know, then it's like, okay, then let's talk about what we can do. And so much of space, because ultimately we invest so little in it, so much of space mm-hmm. is about what we can do, right? It's a self-limiting activity right now that humanity does, is space exploration. And we could do so much more. And that's really exciting that we get to talk about this, about there's nothing holding us back but our own selves. Yeah. And so this is a function of, and space exploration too, in terms of a policy structure, there's no organized anti-space coalition out there, right? There's not the anti-planetary society undermining our work, when there is almost in almost every other situation there is. And so again, our own policy and our own success promoting space exploration in politics is also a function of what we're able to self-organize and organize around. And the problem at the end of the day is just a function of resources, you know, in terms of how much resources we have to throw at it.
Right.
Because of this kind of bigger, more abstract nature, it doesn't have that, you know, human brains, we're designed to react to things that we see and feel that are immediate to us. And so it's, again, that was the whole hypothesis of the Planetary Society, that people could move beyond that. And some, you know, it's astonishing, mm-hmm. great that we've done this for 40 years, you know, but we still don't have the resources of a, you know, like a Sierra Club or a Lockheed Martin, right? Some big moneyed interest, but we do pretty good. So it's a function of those two things. So again, I think positivity, again, that's my default, if nothing else, because that's the world I want to live in. Mm-hmm. And I want to see space. And that's how I engaged with it. Maybe like you, it's like Carl Sagan was my entry point into this, right? Like before mm-hmm. I even knew about the Planetary Society, I was reading the books of Carl Sagan. And what he understood, I think, was that the role of space through this emotional core of humanity, mm-hmm. of piquing your curiosity, of contemplating something bigger than yourself, and then that the power in understanding that lies within, kind of what it does, right? It's just that through the process of science, we can understand these things. That's a very beautiful experience that most people don't have anymore, right? And it's free of any kind of partisanship or parochialness. It's open to everybody, right? And that's can be very powerful. And it's hard to replicate the beauty of and poetry of Sagan's writing, obviously. But I think it serves as this lesson that it's a very, can itself be very powerful over time.
Right. I mean, the slight counter argument to that was that, you know, at the same time, it was fear of competition with the Soviets that really enabled us to realize that. And to some degree, I would say, you know, I'm personally sad about this because I believe in human cooperation. I think we could do more collaborating with the Chinese than competing with them. And which is not to say that there's not good reasons why we're competing, but just on the face of it, more resources for more societies, you know, gets you farther. but it does seem like it's competition with the Chinese that is actually going to get the investment. But I definitely take your point and love your framing of it. You know, just to move on next to sort of, I want to talk about how you think of the art of the possible. And I'm going to frame this a little in, I was listening to a Planetaria radio podcast, Space Policy Edition, and everybody who's listening to this, if you don't already, you should be listening to Planetary Radio. It's great. And Casey, you're great on it. And there was this slightly elliptical discussion about the SLS that came up. Mm-hmm. And you were sort of saying, I'm not going to get the exact wording right. Yes, a lot of people like to dunk on SLS. But if we hadn't had all of these investments over the last 10 years, you know, we wouldn't be talking about Artemis today. Which does sound to me on the face of it a reasonable position, but it also highlights to me how little, to some degree, there's social consensus about the goal of it, right? The reason there was support for SLS isn't because the, you know, relative Congress people cared about space. They cared about jobs in their districts. And to me, you know, how do we change the dynamic of that? Because if you simply said, you know, we're going to work on getting a COVID vaccine, and, you know, okay, maybe we didn't get the vaccine, but at least we employed a lot of people in a lot of districts, like, that would not fly, pun mildly intended. But if you sort of say that for space, you know, SLS can, it feels like, go on as long as it wants, and as long as it's employing the right people in the right places, you know, we will have champions for it. So, you know, how might we change the dynamic so that people care more about the objective and put ourselves thus on a more serious, sustainable path for meeting those objectives rather than what, you know, I've articulated seems to be the case today?
Yeah, so that's also a big question. So this is always a fun one. So that you're paraphrasing, and you did it accurately. My kind of hot take on SLS, which is basically it's the cost of doing business for getting a moon program. And you're right. I think what that does, that framing that I put it as, in a sense, accepts that there is a general lack of public focus on space. And in the absence of strong public interest, it devolves into a certain level of parochialism in terms of the political motivations behind it. And then from there, it's like, okay, what do you do given that you have a bunch of parochial interests? You don't have a wide interest to kind of keep it in check. And I mean, you could just say, like, I want to have 50,000 people here working on NASA's big metal cube project in Huntsville, Alabama, and they're just going to make this big metal cube even bigger, and it's not going to go anywhere, but, you know, it keeps all those people. It's like, at least we're getting kind of, you know, a rocket out of it. But it's like the cost of, it's like a, or the coefficient of the, maybe here's my framing in a slightly different context. I believe this is actually a inevitable outcome of the structures that we have built for ourselves in this representative democratic system, where we have a discretionary activity, right? So optional, NASA, it's not written into the Constitution anywhere, right? It's a very forward-looking document, but not that forward-looking. and it's also, we have a representative political system that is discrete for geographic location. And so the political interests, for the most part, except for the very, very top tier, right, national stuff, are going to be dominated by whatever intersects with that geographic location. And that's what's, at the end of the day, going to be really motivating people, again, except for very nationalized kind of political stuff. And so as a consequence of that, how do you get people in discrete geographic locations to optionally choose money, to optionally commit their time to funding something? It has to have some sort of intersection with their location, right? And So, you know, we have these ideals. It's like when you go into physics 101, right, when people first start taking physics classes, you do all of your problems assuming a frictionless surface, right? You drag some mass across a frictionless surface at some angle, you know, how much force do you need? And it's like, that's great. It's easy to calculate that. It's an ideal case. But in reality, you have friction, right? And so you the force you have to pull something increases because of the friction from the, you know, just the physical reality that you're working on. And that's kind of how I see things like the SLS. That represents the friction of the political system we have being expressed in terms of how we're spending resources. In order to have these programs, and you know, part of it is, it wasn't inevitable. This is all basically the shuttle workforce, which kind of came out of the post-Apollo era infrastructure that we had built up. Mm-hmm. Happened to be in all those places. Those are the places that then care about NASA budgets, because that's where people live and it affects their economy. So they weren't interested in re-election locally by keeping those jobs there. Yes, in an ideal case, you could avoid that. Since we don't live in the ideal case, can we leverage the existence of friction to direct it and build inertia, right? You can tell I was a physics major because all of my metaphors devolve into physics problem sets.
For this audience, I think that's going to work.
Can you build the inertia to your own benefit too? And that's kind of my argument with SLS is because, I mean, and SLS is weird. It was literally in the law. It was written to say destination agnostic. It had no destination. But if you looked at the requirements for it, it could only ever go to the moon. It was always a moon rocket from the beginning, right? And so now that we've pumped all this money into a moon rocket, we better do something at the moon, right? And so now we have this political inertia that's not, you know, it's not how you would first order a priori principles like approach a situation like this, but you can shift, if you can turn the Titanic of a big government bureaucracy to one thing, it's not going to be the most efficient way to do it, but it can be really enduring. And all of this, again, happens, I think, because space is not a broadly engaged national interest of most people, right? And that's kind of the, so this changes if you can get a huge amount of people interested. But then at the same time, there's cost to that as well, right? Climate change is a great example of this. Very big issue, right? Literally impacts every single person alive and future people, as you said. And that hasn't made easy politics around it, right? Like, in fact, it's almost done the opposite. It's created, at least in the US, this kind of bimodal distribution of political opinions on it, despite being one of the most relevant issues. And what has happened was, it's, you know, sometimes the eye of Sauron of the political discourse focuses on something, and that doesn't help the rational application of it. And so in some ways, you can even argue that it's kind of good for space, maybe just to stay a bit on the sidelines and not be the constant. You're seeing I'd be interested to hear what you think of this. I mean, you're seeing this with Bernie Sanders and other people starting to attack aspects of space exploration because of what Jeff Bezos did very publicly and Richard Branson did very publicly with taking these private space flights up. And now suddenly Bernie Sanders is trying to defund NASA's ability to create a second lunar lander, because it's tying into these bigger political partisan issues. And so I think that's actually starts to be what happens when you elevate something to broad national consciousness. It just gets into the churn of all the it doesn't elevate the discussion. It gets pulled down into the partisan debates of the time.
So you have partially answered the next question I was going to ask you, which is a little bit of a critique of this very scientific rationalist approach to politics, which I think creates a ceiling on how much you can ever accomplish. I mean, we have seen that you can actually pull people away from parochialism for really bananas stuff, right? I mean, QAnon, I think we and most people listening to this don't agree with it, but boy, they mobilized some energy around something, right? So, you know, what do you think about moving away from this very calm, measured, in some ways elite style that you would learn at a place like Oberlin or Johns Hopkins or wherever, discourse, and trying to move people's passions on a deeper level, right? I mean, you're sort of there's the realm of, you know, the world as it stands. And I think that's the argument you were making with sort of SLS. Okay, you know, this, take the world as it's given and you can move these cubes around to build a tower. Or can we really remake the nature of the polity around mm-hmm. this? And do we think it's important enough to do so? So I guess, you know, what do you think about that alternative vision where, you know, you escalate the temperature and yes, you create some more enemies around mm-hmm. that, but sometimes great passion is what's needed more than just sort of staying a little bit out of sight and
measured.
I'm just making a case for it.
It's interesting. This is fun. It's a fun topic of discussion because it's, I mean, I'll admit my biases here, right? That type of politic. I see where you're coming from, right? Like, can you ignite some kind of populist movement, basically, right? It is kind of what you're alluding to.
We have to go to Mars, you know, that is right. My identity.
Right. And I guess, I mean, so I'll just admit my bias because I mean, I'm naturally kind of a small c conservative in that I there's that Burkean kind of philosophy where institutions exist for a reason. They've evolved over years and we have to be very thoughtful about what we knock down. And in a sense, because you're describing a more revolutionary, like literal, like revolutionary approach to the politicking behind this. And I think what the danger of that is in general is it's very easy to lose control of that narrative. Like once you unleash that energy, and I think that's what we've seen, and rarely do revolutions work out, even for the people who start them, right? They'll settle with something and then they have a tendency to kind of go on their own path. And so that's against, I mean, so that's why I'm just saying like my nature and my, like how I came into this is a very different type of path. So it just feels different. But I mean, trying to think about it abstractly, let's just for argument's sake, assuming one could ignite a passion for this. And I think that's going to be actually a fundamental challenge. And, you know, we saw, you alluded to Apollo earlier, and I promise this is related to your question, mm-hmm. where it was the competition, as you accurately described it, with the Soviets that unleashed all this funding, and we did Apollo. But after it was done, Apollo ended, right? It was not a sustainable way to do it, like because being angry, your anger can fade too, mm-hmm. right? And it can be very powerful. But then sometimes you're like, man, what did I say to that person? I was really angry. I really regret that. And there was kind of this post-Apollo hangover in the space program too, where it was like, wow, we really spent a lot of money there. I guess we don't need to do that one again. And we haven't, right? But we had this expectation, you know, it is this kind of curse at the same time. And I think even in that situation, actually, with Apollo, it was an elite capture, not a population capture, a populist capture, mm-hmm. Right? And you can see public polling from the era of Apollo was never particularly popular. It was always seen very briefly, reached more than 50% kind of overall worth it kind of approval polling right after Apollo 11 landed and then quickly fell back down to like 30 or 40%. But that was removed completely from the political system, which at the time was like unquestioned, like we got to do this. And so I think there is a challenge to igniting this type of demand and passion unless there's some kind of clear connection to the individual. Right. And I think that's at the end of the day, what's difficult with space. It's one of the most abstract concepts.
Yes.
You know, it's. Whether it's for human or robotics, it's just, it's not like anything, by definition, it's not like anything we have personal experience with, right? Mm-hmm. And when it does phase in, you know, sometimes what happens is space phases into the things that we have immediate visceral reactions to, Apollo being one of those, then it can really unleash some momentum behind it. But when it phases out of that, it's really hard to sustain. And I think, so it's just, I mean, to answer your question, I guess I don't know, but I grow weary at the idea of unleashing that kind of, if you could, can you direct it? Because then at the same time, you say, what are we doing this for if we're abandoning these kind of noble principles for this broader passion movement? And do you undermine your integrity and goals by trying to abandon the whole point of it, at least in my field, in my interpretation of it, that it brings out the best in ourselves by doing it? And maybe the payoff is maybe it's better to accept a little less in order to encompass these goals. I mean, if you go back, it's even like, it's interesting, like you go back to movies like 2001, the very early space age, Arthur C. Clarke kind of stuff, where going into space was seen as this way to literally push humanity, transcend itself into this new plane of being, right? Into this higher level of being. Like it would mediate our transition from this kind of territorial ape into this angelic, high-minded future. And space was going to leverage us into that by doing it because of its difficult, because it requires cooperation, because it requires thoughtful, like it doesn't matter what your faith is for whether humans can breathe, like space is going to, by physics and biology, you're not going to breathe without air, right? It forces a certain level of rationality. So I don't want to personally abandon those principles, but and I wonder if you even could. So I don't know. That's my very long response.
I really appreciate how thoughtful you are. And you know, half the reason I do these podcasts is because these are the conversations I want to have.
Sure.
but I think it also points to the fact, you know, that there's room for multiple voices, institutions, and approaches. And I think, you know, there's the more measured scientific is the dominant one right now. And I think, you know, sort of you've got folks like, you know, Scott Manley, who speaks in very measured tone and is a wonderfully effective space communicator. But you are starting to have folks like, you know, the angry astronaut. I don't know if you've ever listened to Jordan's stuff, but like he takes an emotional tone to motivate people. And I think he may be bringing in a different audience. And then, you know, you have, you know, and Jordan, I'd love to have you on the show. So hopefully I'll be talking to you directly at some point. And then you have, you know, Celestial Citizen with Brit, who's sort of aligning it with social and equity principles. And that's another way to get additional people. So, you know, I think it's not necessarily either or. Perhaps one institution can only take one approach at a time. But, you know, if you multiply that, you can do more. Moving on a little, a lot of what the Planetary Society appears to do relates to influencing budgets, and especially the U.S. federal budget. So how do you think about what the proper investments in space are, and sort of, you know, how do we know whether the budget should be 2x, 10x, or maybe half of what it is today?
Right. And I just to touch on the closing part of your last topic, I think that's right. I just wanted to say, I think that's an interesting, and that's what's great, I think, is to have, I don't think there is a single answer to this in terms of how you motivate people. And I think it is going to be interesting to see, particularly with, as we've seen with everything with the internet, more voices coming in and representing different groups. Mm-hmm. And people can find something that resonates with them. And at the end of the day, what we, going into space, it's just, in a sense, it's always going to be a reflection. We're just going to bring, you know, it's a reflection of ourselves. It's always been and will continue to be a very powerful symbol, space, right? And it's so broad a concept and how we do it, it's never going to be one thing. And so it's going to echo ourselves, right? And I think it's much more interesting when there's a cacophony of voices than if there's just one monotone going through. And it's going to be fascinating to see kind of what resonates with people going forward. And I think that's why I wanted to like be clear from answering your question, was that I'm bringing in a certain set of, in a sense, biases of how I came into it, right? And what resonated with me. And I'm probably, if you're by listening, a slightly more cerebral, chatty, over analytical person. And that's going to be, so that's what, you know, I have this whole superstructure of kind of philosophy and motivation and sociology that I've, you know, that works in my head. But I'm not most people, like, by definition, I'm not most people. Right. And so it's interesting to see what's resonating with other people at the same time. And I think the whole like kind of somewhat fanboy base around things like SpaceX is actually really fascinating development to me, because at the end of the day, I think the big transition in particularly with commercial and private space, the social transformation has been it's increased accessibility to being space adjacent in a way that people had talked about doing for decades and never really pulled off. Right. So suddenly, and I think you did that by adding personal motivation and greed, not to be pejorative about it, but just like, it's a very motivating thing. That's how our capitalist system works, is that there has to be something in it. So it's like, not only can I do something for space, but I can make money and I can bring that kind of general to simplify kind of tech attitude of like, well, I can do something. I can start a startup. I can bring something to this. And suddenly you're in the space business. That's actually really exciting to me. And because before it was, you go work for a big prime contractor and you design CAD drawings for 20 years. And maybe one of those, you have a screw on a rocket that goes up once every 2 years. But now you can actually build and blow up things. And suddenly you're increasing the scope of this. And so, and again, I don't mean to be pejorative by fanboyism. I just don't know how better to describe it. That it's created a more social aspect of it and a more broad connection to it. And you see different layers of engagement with it. And overall, I think that's a really good thing, because it's making it suddenly makes it more relevant to people, and it's bringing excitement, bringing new people into it, and it's bringing expectations into it, which I think we should have. And I think those are filtering through even on the government side. So anyway, I just wanted to follow up on that, because you kind of bring to space, you know, what you have. And again, it kind of echoes it back to you. And that's what's so great about it. I mean, it's, I don't know if you've heard, space is quite big. I think there's room for all these types of things here. And, you know, and how you do all these different types of things, right? And I think, because even when we're talking here about space, you know, you're in particular, you're talking about like multi-planetary species. I'm really into like the robotic scientific exploration of space, which is almost always going to be kind of a function of government spending, because it's just a basic R&D thing. Then there's commercialization, there's privatization, there's tourism. All these other things are kind of opening up and blossoming, and there's room for all of it, right? The space is, again, quite big. So it's going to be really fun to see how that all works out, and that ideally we have this mature multimodal culture and society reflected in the activities that we do in space. To answer the question you actually asked about budgets, those are, the way I approach budgets, and, you know, because there was this popular thing for a while with penny for NASA, right? For those of you who remember that, it's like basically a penny of every federal expenditure as a percentage should go to NASA, which would be great. It would functionally double that.
1% of the federal government.
1% of the federal budget, yeah. For those of you who don't know, NASA is less than half of 1%. And it gets a bit to be a bit more accurate about it, because I'm a numbers guy. The entire federal budget includes what's called mandatory spending, which is, as it sounds like, things like Social Security, Medicare, payments on the federal debt, things that are literally written into law that regardless, you know, Congress doesn't approve those every year. It's like they set out criteria for expenditures. So Social Security, like if people qualify and sign up for Social Security, they just get this money. The more people sign up for it, the more they'll spend, right? The Congress is not approving that every year. So in a way, it's kind of inaccurate, and it's not an active political discussion,
right,
about how much we spend on mandatory things. They happen to make up approximately 2/3 to 3/4 of all of our, the entire, what the government spends. And so, I mean, that's like a very loaded discussion to have about what we should. So I'm just not going to say what we should or shouldn't do with that. Just like just to acknowledge the reality that the vast majority of government spending is
the government is mostly a military with a social insurance policy attached to it.
Exactly.
And then there's a little bit of.
Yeah. So but notably, here's the interesting thing. So all the mandatory stuff is the social insurance programs. Of the money that the government does, that the Congress does argue about spending every year, so about, let's say, about a third. We're talking about $1.5 trillion a year, just for rough numbers here. Half of that, then, just lop that in half, and that's what military spending is, right? So that's actually a discretionary expenditure, is military, but obviously that one's written into the Constitution, the common defense of the nation. And there's much, that's how you build a big program. Everyone gets a piece of that, right? That everyone has some kind of contract with that. So you lop that off, right? That's a sixth of all government spending is military spending. Everything else the government does, right? Every other department, every other activity is a pretty much a function of that last sixth of that whole overall spending. So the discretionary amount, the $1.5 trillion, NASA gets about 1.5% of that, right? So it's just it's a third, so 0.5% times 3. Not huge, right? But that's the actual political debate about what percentage of discretionary money that NASA gets. Sure. Everything else is a non-political debate. So I think that's a subtle but important discussion there. And that gets set by, the overall top level spending gets set by very high level congressional committees based on political stuff. It's grown over the years, thankfully, because I think we should be spending more on some basic kind of functions. Again, it's like such a small amount of what we actually spend. So the political debate about where we start with NASA then isn't just what I started with. This was penny for NASA and say, okay, let's just double NASA's budget. Well, it doesn't really work that way because you don't just set a random number and then you backfill in what you do with it. And this is where, going back to the very beginning of this discussion, I said, you have to start with what you want to do, yeah. Right? And what you want to do should then define what you ask for in terms of budget to do it. And, and that's obviously kind of an extreme ideal case, but I think that's the proper direction, a way to think about it. So if NASA wants to go to the moon and wants to have humans there and wants to have a robotic program and wants to do aeronautics and wants to do education, you have to start out with your goals and then those inform your budget. And I think that's the only way to make a good case, because then you can say, it's not like we just double a budget, then we'll figure out what to do with it. It's, we want to do this. This is why it's good. This is how it's going to benefit everybody. And then this is what it takes to do it. And that then, even if it is a big ask or a small one, you can justify it, right? You're saying, this is why we need it. And that tends to resonate more. And then if you don't get it, you can say, okay, the consequence is, if I didn't get what I asked for, this will happen. Because
although we have the challenge here that sort of the things that we want to do are a bit fuzzy. So, I think planetary defense is probably the easiest one to make the case for, even though it may not be the easiest one to get the money for, as we
ironically, see.
But sort of finding life.
Yeah.
You probably couldn't even tell me like what is the exact amount. I personally have suspicions there may be bacterial life in our solar system. Mm-hmm. But I can't tell you that, going to Enceladus or, Europa is gonna, and having a lander and a probe and a swimmer is going to get you there. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, but how would you think about, so first principles, we want to find life. How would you think about telling Congress what the right budget is for that?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. That's actually one of the big projects I'll be doing in the next 2 years is kind of actual thing. Yeah. But the way that I would approach it would be, you can't guarantee a fundamental discovery. I actually submitted a paper to what's called a decadal survey, big report from the National Academies of Sciences, and arguing for why search for life is so important. But you can't, it's funny because it would be a fundamental revolution in our understanding of the cosmos. Mm-hmm. But we don't know if it's there, but we actually know how to look for it, right? Like we can invest in things that'll give us a chance to find it, mm-hmm. if it's there, right? And so we actually have a pretty good sense of guideposts that'll say, here's where to look. And mm-hmm. so I think we can get reasonably close to, and the way we would say, I can't guarantee you'll find life, but if you want to try to find life, here's where we go. Here's the most promising things, and here's how we would do it. This is what it takes. And so I think to some extent, NASA's kind of doing that. It's just going to be slow and kind of stretched out, but say, we know the ocean worlds are very positive opportunities. We know subsurface ice in Mars is a really high opportunity. Maybe the atmosphere of Venus, though that's looking less likely. And then what the astronomy community just proposed, this next generation space telescope that can do basically a statistical survey of exoplanets for biosignatures, mm-hmm. looking at hundreds of planets to say if we find, if there's going to be some sort of notable oxygen line or methane line, we'll look at hundreds of them and give us a sense of, how common this is or is not. And even a mm-hmm. null detection there would tell us something, right? And so we have a number of, and so then you can work backward and say, okay, if you want to make searching for life a priority, those should be the top missions that we're funding. Those are all going to be flagship missions for the part. You could do a series of smaller missions to give you initial kind of surveys, like flying through the plumes of Enceladus with a mass spectrometer that can do some like statistical analysis of your mass distributions and give you a sense of, oh, maybe there's something non-equilibria here, right? All of life is basically sitting in a non-equilibrium. And so if you find anything off equilibrium in nature, that's a potential biosignature, right? So it's, you have basically, my point is you have kind of a set of things. You can't say an exact number, but you can say this is what a serious program would look like. And we're not doing that. And so we can fund, you know, a Europa lander. We know how much that would cost, give or take, right? And that's the, so we have more guideposts than I think you're giving it credit for here. But at the same time, you can only talk about it in risk, right? Like, if you want to find it, this is how we'd find it. If it's there, if it's not there.
and should we consider as a social movement looking to the private sector? So, you know, should we go to Bezos? Or, I mean, there's actually a lot of billionaires out there whose names aren't well known.
Great one.
Yeah. So, and say, you know, look, we believe that if you spend $5 billion, you could potentially really make a, you know, progress on discovering whether there's life out there. I promise, you know, if that happens, you will be in the history books for the next 100 years, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, there's a tendency in space because the numbers have been so big to, you know, look at the public sector. And it's nice in a way that that's then a collective endeavor. But, you know, things have changed a lot. Should we look to the private sector and private individuals now to do some of this?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think there's a complementary way to do that. To what the public sector is doing. And in general, though, you're just going to be really stuck with the idiosyncratic interests of your whatever 500 billionaires that you have to choose from.
And they kind of need to be deca billionaire. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Ordinary billionaires aren't going to cut it.
Well, because I'll go on a brief aside of
please do
with private space. I think that there's a tendency just to assume it will always be cheaper. But what you get where commercial space really thrives and where it's really effective so far that we've seen is when we can leverage the benefits of mass production, right? I mean, at the end of the day, that's kind of really where you get your cost savings. So companies like Planet, where you're building, you're kind of stamping off like dozens and dozens of these little Earth observing satellites. Companies like SpaceX, where you're building Falcon 9s, or you're building Starlinks, like they're all, you know, they're iterating on them, but they're just building one kind. Even Commercial Crew, you're building four of the same Commercial Crew spacecraft. The issue with scientific missions is that the conditions and the scientific needs that drive the motivation of why you're going tend to be different enough that it's almost impossible to find common hardware heritage in order to stamp off like this common science probe. Or hardware, right? And so there could be exceptions to this. Like if you wanted to do two dozen rovers on the surface of Mars, Mars is unexplored enough still that you would do that and find some really interesting stuff. But for going to different locations, it's actually really, and NASA's tried this over the years, and it's just hard to leverage that kind of scaling to really save you money. The other thing is what you tend to pay for in these missions is people. So you might be able to save a little bit in terms of not having the bureaucratic overhead of a big government agency. So I think you could find some cost savings, but I don't think it would be orders of magnitude cheaper. And I think we've saw this with, I think Breakthrough, that's the Yuri Milner group, who is, I believe, a deca billionaire. He's funding in a great way, funding tons of money at SETI, which is awesome, right? And he bought the contact. He bought Jodie Foster's contact pitch, basically, is like what he's doing. He's Haddon. But for a brief time, they were talking about doing a private mission to Enceladus. And then that just disappeared, probably because they were like this will cost maybe $250 million to $500 million to get there. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot even for a billionaire to pay for an uncertain outcome. And so Jeff Bezos might be able to do it. I hope he does. He seems more interested in the infrastructure building, as he calls it, the road path to space. And that's where you get, at the end of the day, these kind of idiosyncratic interests. So you just can't depend on it. And I think that's what, and also at the same time, you can't convince somebody who doesn't want to be convinced. You can't have like a public campaign. There's no, at the end of the day, we have public spaceflight through, you know, however many layers is answerable to the people who are paying for it, and have built in opportunities for public input, public oversight through Congress, through representatives in Congress. And you have the opportunity to direct it in those ways. And for private stuff, again, I really hope people do this, but it's just, it's going to be a function of individual, a handful of very wealthy individuals who want to do that. So it's just, and then why are they doing it? Are they going to have the patience to see through it? If there's a failure, would they tolerate a failure? So that adds the complexity to me. But again, at the end of the day, we're seeing promise for that. And I think, again, what we're seeing is really, I think Yuri Milner with SETI, that's smart money. That's like only $100 million, right, for him, not very much money. And you could do, there's so little otherwise being spent on it, that huge impact.
Right.
But if you're competing against, like, NASA's going to spend $5 billion on a Europa Clipper mission, like, yeah, that's a big chunk of change. And that's not like them throwing away money. That's just because you're sending it to one of the harshest radiation environments, and it has to work, right? And it has to all this exquisite science. And even then, who knows what the outcome is going to be.
I know we're running close to our time, but I'm hoping we can cover two final questions fairly quickly. One, does the Planetary Society or you personally believe that humanity should become a multiplanetary species in the sense of some sort of year-round settlement on another planet?
I will say the Planetary Society is all for the scientific exploration of other planets with humans. And that at this point doesn't include long-term permanent habitation, is not part of that official policy. I personally think it's a great idea. So I just want to.
Why?
And that's not like we're against it. It's just like that's what the focus. The Society is a science organization at its core. And so having like the equivalent of like Antarctica stations on Mars, I think would be a huge and wonderful thing. And then you start building out from there. I think personally, one of the very few unique arguments for going to Mars and other planets is to be multiplanetary, right? And how do you ensure that the reason you go to Mars that you couldn't just say, why couldn't a robot just do it, is literally to have the person at Mars, right? And yes. Why do you have people at Mars long-term in order to have ultimately a society that's expanding outwards? And I think there's actually a really great, really good argument for cultural revival that comes from having an expansionary mindset in a, and I just, to be clear, in a peaceful and thoughtful and right, respectful way, right? And Mars is perfect, right? Well, you can say there may be a side debate about we check it as much as we can. Are there things already living there, and how do we deal with that if there are? But assuming there's not, then there's no reason why we shouldn't go there,
yeah,
right? And it's not like you're going to displace people or there's existing cultures to upset or take or destroy. It's open space. And I think at the long term, having this kind of open mindset, of a horizon mindset, looking forward, looking out. I always talk about how that kind of attitude, space is this antidote for our current culture that pulls us literally down. And you're looking at your phone, your head is down, right? You're going through social media. You're usually talking or thinking about other people, right? So it's just like this very internal, inward looking, reflective thousand mirrors kind of culture that's just, your head is literally being pulled down. Space literally pulls you up and out, right? And yes, it just pulls you, and it makes you contemplate and integrate new information that you did not have before, right? It's an additive activity, right? So it challenges your understanding of the world. It challenges your hypothesis. You can test things that you've only developed on Earth if they apply truly universally, right? In a literal sense. And so I think having this kind of mindset of going further out would be a wonderful strain of energy in our culture to conceive of.
Do you buy the insurance policy approach to this?
In the very long term, right? I mean, I think we need to be really clear. I always think about how far are we from creating 5-nanometer silicon chips on the surface of Mars, right? Like through a 5-nanometer process or any computer chips, right?
I see where you're going with. Yes.
Think of the industrial process from mining to refinement to these highly specialized supply chains to feed into the ability to just pump out computer chips. And so like right now, like for, I couldn't imagine, maybe, you know, could be wrong, be happily prove me wrong, somebody, 100 years on Mars, if there's people even living there, I don't think they'll be able to make their own computers. So if their computer breaks, they have to ship a new one from Earth, right? Mm. Where are you going to get plastic from? Plastic comes from oil derived products, right? Where are you going to get plastic from on Mars? So having some sort of completely independent backup site for humanity, again, on the long term, is a reasonable thing to do, right? But I think we just need to be really, really honest, right? That it's not something you just do in our, even in a few generations from here, but someone's got to start it, right? And I think there's value to that.
And speaking of people starting things, I know we're at a time, but I'd love to close us out to hear just a little bit of your personal story.
Sure.
How did you get involved in all of this?
I'll give the quick version. I had always been into space as a kid, right? Always loved space, and I always loved space science. I took Lego kits and created like the Viking lander, my own like Viking lander out of them, and I was obsessed with Voyager. Awesome. So I was into the planetary probes. You know, as one grows up, they kind of, you know, you lose that sometimes. Or I went to college and got my physics degree, and it's like, oh, this is actually really hard. And my physics degree was in physics and astronomy, but then I was kind of done, you know. So then I went into software, and I did software for many years. And my met a woman, became my wife, and she, unlike me, didn't give up. And she became a she was a graduate student in planetary science, and she was on the Curiosity rover mission team. Wow. And in the fall of 2011, we went down to Kennedy Space Center and saw the mission launch on an Atlas V. And it was my first space launch. If anyone listening has never been to a rocket launch, please add that to your list of things to do, because for me, it was a transcendental experience, right? It was sitting, we sat with the science team, so people who'd spent the last 10 years of their lives pouring their hearts and souls into this mission, so that all of their ambitions, dreams, future, and careers were sitting at the top of that big rocket, right? That, that, you know, generally works, but sometimes doesn't. And so as you were counting down, right, it got successively quieter and quieter and quieter, and the tension grew and grew and grew in the section we were seating. And then it hit zero, and there was like this brief pause, which in retrospect, I didn't know, because the SRBs were firing, but you couldn't see them right above the horizon where we were. So there was this pause, we're just sat. And then boom, it just like shot off the ground. And then like everyone in this crowd just screamed and lost their minds, and all of that tension released as we watched this rocket. And then the sound hits you, and then you see the brightness of the flare. And I realized like, all of this intensity and this energy, thousands of people to build this rocket, all this effort and money to build it, is just to say that weird little, you know, pink star in the sky, what's it like? Right. Like that's at the end of the day. What a beautiful intention of that literal curiosity driving that. And it was this moving moment. It was my conversion moment. Right. Whereas that day, I was like, why am I not doing everything I can to help keep this happening? And so that night I resolved to change my career. And I said that actually I was to work at the Planetary Society, because that's the only organization I knew at the, you know, and that's still actually a few others, that has the organizes people to support this stuff. And very fortunately, my wife was starting a postdoc in Los Angeles. We moved out there. I started just kind of showing up at their door, somehow convinced them to hire me, and then started doing the policy and advocacy. And that was 8 years ago. And basically kind of went back to school, and now it became an expert in space policy and public policy. And now I get to share that passion with people and to organize people and to empower them to be space advocates. And, you know, we've seen really amazing strides in Mars since then and exploration since then. And I think it's been profound to see space expand as this, the number of participants aren't just, and that's what I was saying earlier, that the number and types of ways that we go into space now is it's probably truly the most exciting time in space since the Apollo era, the 1960s. And to think about this every day and to help people get more engaged in it is just a true dream come true, like a true pleasure to do. And so I feel just profoundly fortunate to be able to do this. But it really did come from that moment of grace, really, watching a rocket launch to Mars and transform my life.
Well, that is a really inspiring story. And I love the fact that it brings actually your professional and personal life together.
Yeah.
Casey, thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, yeah. It was a delight. Thanks for having me.
Thank you to Casey for joining the Multiplanetary Society podcast. And thank you to all of our listeners. If you like this content, please make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcasting platform to ensure you don't miss an episode, and leave a review to help others find it. If you have any feedback or guest suggestions, please feel free to email us at multiplanetarysociety, all one word, with no dashes, @gmail.com. We look forward to having you join us for the next conversation.